Welcome, members and guests, to the February 28th program of the City Club of Eugene. Welcome our TV audiences on community television and the Oregon Wind Network. I'm James Baldock, President-elect. Please don't forget, parking at the Overpark can be validated at the registration desk. Parking is free to all of our programs in the Overpark. Just check in at the registration desk for a validated parking ticket. Our sponsors today are the Oregon Country Fair, Hearing Associates, Dr. Gail Leslie, Dr. Sandra Ibarra, and Dr. Brad Smith, Dot Dodson's, and a special thank you to KLCC for airing the programs on Monday night and KPFF Consulting Engineers for our office space. We thank you for listening. These programs are free to our listening audience, yet there are costs involved. Your contribution is completely tax deductible and will help keep our organization healthy. Today's presenter is Susan Band, Shelter Care Executive Director, who will discuss the topic of the Shelter Care and the WIT, renovating buildings and reviving lives. We're going to have Dan Bryant introduce our guest speaker.
So I think we are all aware of the issue of homelessness in our community and how severe, or at least have a notion of that it is a severe problem. I was curious myself as just to how severe, and so I've been working with the data from the one-night homeless count that is conducted every 2 years and began comparing that to population data from the Census Bureau for those regions. And after going through and matching all that up and with my 10th grade math skills, because that's as far as I made it, not in school, just in math, calculated the per capita homelessness rate for each of the areas. And I discovered, though, Lane County ranks 141st in terms of population of the different areas that report. We come out on a per capita basis as 19th in the nation for the highest rate of unsheltered homeless. And the other 18 are all in California, Florida, and Hawaii, which means that we have the highest rate of unsheltered homeless in 47 states. That, to me, is just an astounding statistic. And very disturbing, and explains a lot of why we see so many people on the street with their signs and so forth. Well, one of the heroes in this community that has been working on this issue for such a long time, of course, is Susan Band. Susan came to this community through a church position. She's actually an ordained minister, is another reason why she's close to my own heart, a fellow colleague of the cloth, so to speak. Began as a volunteer with Shelter Care and worked her way onto the board and then became the executive director in 1991, which just so happens is the same year that I came to this community to serve First Christian Church downtown. And so I have admired Susan greatly as I've worked with her in many capacities over the last 20-plus years. And indeed, it's because of Susan that I became a part of City Club, because she was president of the club at the time when I joined in 1996. So Susan is here to talk to us about a new program of Shelter Care, and let me just quickly report to you that Shelter Care has three basic services: emergency services for homeless families, in which they have three facilities; mental health services, in which they have six facilities; and brain injury services, in which they have two. And all total, they have about 300 units, apartments, for these various programs, and serve about 1,700 clients every year. So we are very thankful for the work that Shelter Care does, and especially that Susan does in our community. And she's going to share with us today about this new program that they are working on to centralize many of the services in the new facility they have in the Whitaker neighborhood. So we welcome Susan to the program.
Thank you very much for allowing me to be here today and to talk about the vision that is coming alive at our new facility at 499 West 4th in the Whitaker neighborhood. It is an inspiring, transformative project for our work. And it will help us, I think, in new and interesting ways address the challenges that have been in our community for a very long time. So my goal today is to talk about, first, the features of the facility we are renovating, to explain why we are making this transformative leap into a new model of care, and to describe the powerful improvements to programming and outcomes for our clients that this transition will allow. As Dan referenced, ShelterCare has been in the community providing services that address homelessness since 1970. And after 43 years of service to the community, we are making a bold step toward a new future measured by positive outcomes for the populations we serve. So first, let me tell you some information about the building in Whittaker. And for those of you who love history and architecture, this is where you put on your imaginary glasses and listen. So the facility's footprint first shows up on a Sanborn insurance map dating back to 1926. The structure was built 1937, early 1940s. It is cast-in-place concrete walls, heavy timber columns, beams of solid fir, both above and below the floor. This building is going nowhere and is as earthquake-proof as they come. The columns are 12 inches by 12 inches. The beams are 12 inches by 27 inches and come from very tall trees. They stretch across the building. The space we are renovating is 22,000 blank square feet. Just empty, well, not anymore, but because Pivot and McKenzie Commercial have been working really hard on it, but it was a blank tablet for us. The ceiling height is 15 feet at the high point. The exterior has pilasters that have an Art Deco influence. The building is bright, open, warm, welcoming. The ceiling will be open throughout the building. Therapy rooms, confidential spaces, offices will be capped, but you'll still be able to see the beams. And the original wood of the beams will remain. We were so excited when we learned that we did not have to paint them. We can power wash them, and that saves the project about $22,000, which is no small savings, and allows us the beauty of the wood. There's a commons in the center of the building that will unite all the various programs and sections, the clinical section with the housing section with the homelessness prevention section. The front lobby will have client computers and an area for children to play. We're right across from the Washington Jefferson Park. We're a block from the skate park. The railroad lines up against the back of the building, and like I said, we're on the corner of 4th and Washington, and you are all invited to come visit, or you can go to the website and see pictures of the construction underway. This building is in the heart of our constellation of programs. So we have a facility that's on Main Street in Springfield and at 11th. We have a facility that's at 30th and Willamette. We have a facility where River Road hits the Beltline, and one at Coburg Road at Beltline. And we have several other facilities within that circle. And here, this big building now is in the very center of all that and will help us consolidate services but also cut down on unnecessary travel and make it more easily accessible to the clients, the families, and the individuals we serve right on a bus line close to downtown. Why did we invest in a permanent facility? We've avoided doing so for our 43 years of existence. We've typically prioritized capital investments to go into our residential homes or to expand the residential and housing resources we have for our consumers. But Looking Glass bought the building that we were in, leasing office space. That was about 5 years ago. And they gave us 3 years to find a new home. And at that point, we stepped back and said, what do we really need? We were renting multiple spaces across the town for our maintenance crew, for storage, for administrative functions. And we also knew that emerging models of care were really encouraging us to integrate services and integrate specialties so that our housing team would be co-located with our clinical team, that would be co-located with our supported employment team, that our clinicians, the therapists who do intakes and treatment plans and assessments, could be all co-located in the same place. Well, that sort of required a different kind of building. And we looked all over town. We looked way out in Mohawk and way out on west of 11th. We looked at industrial areas. It was 2008, and there was a lot of empty space, and we looked at offices that had been abandoned. And then this building came on the market, and we looked at it, and it would allow us to do several things. It would allow us, one, to be center with all those programs. It would allow us to bring in all these services and shape a space to actually accommodate both a warehouse, a construction crew's workplace, clinical space, and administrative offices. So that's why we did. There's several benefits. The central location really will make it much more convenient for our families, for our consumers, and will cut down on travel costs. We can consolidate services, reducing costs, and offering integrated services, which truly is improved clinical quality for the people we serve. It lowered our cost for the space. By the time we stopped all those leases and all those other spaces, the mortgage that we're paying on the current facility is less than what we were paying before, so it's a cost-saving method. We got the mortgage through Oregon Facilities Administration's small nonprofit assistance program, so it's a very low rate, specifically for nonprofits, and it gives us financial strength because the building is an asset for us going forward. So the transformation we imagine is a leap in quality, an integration of services. This construction of a historic warehouse enhances our ability now to do new and improved services for our consumers. A little bit more about the building. It has, first of all, there's a clear therapeutic improvement by having services in a building that looks good, that's respectable, that's dignified. So people coming to a building feel like they're coming to a therapeutic and professional space. And that's just a step above. A lot of our services are done currently out of motels, and motels that are aging and wearing. So this will immediately provide an improved treatment option for the people we're serving. But it also includes a kitchen. There's a free store in the back. We have basic household supplies when families are ready to move out of shelter or individuals are moving out of shelter into their own apartment. They often need help with linens, kitchen appliances, small tables, beds, mattresses, and we keep those materials donated to us so that families and individuals can find them. There will be a children's play area, a computer area, a central meeting room that our consumer council will use. We have residents at each of our programs come together once a month to counsel us on rather important policies and protocols. One of the first things they did was ask us to make a uniform grievance policy that they helped to write so that across all of the different programs, the pathway to bringing a complaint or a grievance would be the same and included consumer voice. So they have been meeting actively for almost a decade and will have their own space and their own pause point where they can call out their mission and the way they influence the work we do. And so then let me talk about the new programs for a few minutes. Here are some of the programs that will benefit from this new space. Homelessness prevention and rapid rehousing. Now, we know nationally that it's so much better to prevent homelessness at all or resolve it very quickly, and that's what we call rapid rehousing. So families don't have to go through an experience of a shelter stay. They're moved immediately back into housing. We do have a homeless prevention rapid rehousing program. Right now it's in a tiny residential unit out at Family Housing Program way out on Highway 99, which is not accessible to families. And even if families were to show up, there's no room in that office for them to meet and certainly no place for kids to play other than if they're playing with a stapler on the desk, which is not particularly safe. So we're creating a new space for this group that can now allow walk-in traffic, as well as continuing to do the phone and the outreach traffic that they do now. But families can actually come to the site. Even more, they can be connected to the other services on the site. We have supported employment specialists, housing specialists, residential specialists, and even clinical specialists that can help families connect more broadly to the community. We do, like I say, have housing and residential specialists on site. They'll be located here. They will help be able to help with consumers coming. We use the word consumers, meaning program participants or residents or clients, but coming to the facility for services. And these specialists help people often with the daunting task of filling out paperwork, figuring out where in the community to find housing, how do you navigate with a landlord, what are the steps, and also are there resources to help you with application fees, first and last month rent, and the kinds of costs and processes all required to getting into housing. We'll be adding integrated alcohol and substance abuse treatment. We have all the pieces of our application for a license in place. The only thing that's missing is that we don't have an office space. We could not put that licensed service in any of our residential facilities without requiring a residential license. In order to get an outpatient license, we have to have an outpatient setting. So as soon as the building's up and running, we will have an office that's dedicated for alcohol and drug abuse services, and we'll be able to complete the license application to the state. What this allows is for our caregivers to integrate mental health and substance abuse treatment. When they're integrated, the outcomes are so much better. They're tied into the full care management team. All of the rest of the clinicians on the team are on the same page, and we're really able to help people make that next step transition into a community provider for those same services, and they'll be successful in engaging in community-based services. We have a supported employment team, two people who specialize in helping people get into the workforce, again, preparing resumes, finding jobs, also with education, if they want to enhance their education. A lot of our the people who are in our programs want to work. They may not be able to work full-time, but with supports, they can work at meaningful jobs and feel like they're contributing and investing back into the community. I already talked about the free store in the back. The other thing that this building will allow us to do is create a centralized waiting list. We have multiple programs that are residential programs, and every single one of them has had a separate application process. I remember a man coming in the door at one point, and Jerry, you'll have sympathy with this, but sitting down and filling out six separate forms for housing. And it was disrespectful, and it was frustrating, and especially for people who are having a hard time navigating paperwork to kind of have to do six different processes was really not a good thing. So now we've put them all into one process. The problem is we don't yet have the systems in place to manage that process. And what I'm truly hoping is in this new building we'll be able to apply some triage, intake, assessment, immediate outreach services to make sure that we are serving the most needy in a priority order that makes the most sense. We are intrigued by some of the vulnerability indexes that are being used in other parts of our country to really recognize who has the most need, who's been the highest user of the emergency department, who's had the most impact on the EMT system, who has maybe multiple medical needs that need to be addressed as well as a substance abuse or a mental health issue. So if we can begin doing that deeper analysis of who's coming to our door, we'll be able to, I believe, to serve those most in need first. So that's a goal. Reverse integration of medical services with the Accountable Care Organization and the rollout of the CCOs in Oregon, one of the big goals is called integrated care. And we've talked about integration of care, meaning that a behavioral health specialist is embedded into a primary care medical home. Well, the reverse integration concept is that you take a medical care provider, a nurse practitioner or a medical doctor, and embed them in the behavioral health home. Well, that's where we're going. We will be creating a behavioral health home for our clients where we're covering all aspects of their care. And in order to do that most effectively, we introduce medical care too. In one of our programs, we know that more than a third of the clients we serve have two or more chronic physical problems like diabetes, COPD, heart disease. And in addition to that, they're battling mental illness and substance abuse. So integrating treatment is really important. Another statistic is when these we serve people who've been on the street for a long time, and at the Inside program, we track that hospitalizations drop 87% once somebody has moved into housing, so that they are no longer using the emergency department to meet all their needs. They're connected with the primary care home, and our staff are able to really help them use those community connections effectively. So that's reverse integration. I want two more programs. We do have a community health worker. A community health worker is someone who actually helps an individual navigate the medical system, make sure they keep appointments, make sure they get their medical supplies, their durable supplies, make sure that they have access to prescriptions and medications, helps them with their wellness activities, helps them read their glucose meters or do their walk every day or whatever it takes for them to improve their health. That's the community health worker. Ours is funded by United Way, and the initial results in the year that we've had her on site and acting with our programs have been amazing. Kind of medical symptomology has gone down, engagement has gone up, and people have actually dropped in their use of higher-end levels of care. Finally, homeless medical respite. Some of you may have heard about this. When people who have been chronically homeless have a hospitalization for an acute care episode, often it can be a heart attack, it can be operation, it can be wound care. To release them from the hospital back into homelessness is almost a guarantee that they'll be entering the emergency room and the long-term medical floors again. So in cooperation with Sacred Heart and with Trillium, we have started a 30-day homeless medical respite program. People come to the hospital to our 30-day program, and our community health worker and our other coordinated care workers work very hard with that individual so that at the end of that 30 days, they're moving into transitional housing and they are wrapped, they have a primary care provider that they're set up with, and they have supports that are wrapped around them. And so far, we started our first referral was October, moving into our program in November. And so far, we've had remarkable success and have moved, I think, three or four people out of that program into transitional housing, with some of them also now in the queue for permanent housing. So those are the kinds of things this facility can allow us to do in a coordinated way. Two final points. We do not do this work alone. Our partners are close collaborators. We work with other nonprofits like Catholic Community Services, Looking Glass, St. Vincent de Paul, Women's Space. We work with the county, Lane County Behavioral Health, Human Services Commission, Housing and Community Services Agency, with Cornerstone, which was formerly Metropolitan Affordable Housing. We have participation to get people into housing, and the cities of Eugene, Springfield also are close advocates and allies to our work. And as much as we're doing, we're barely touching the need. It's been outrageously frustrating to have watched poverty in our community climb over the past 20 years. And at the rate it's climbing and the gap, the affordability gap for housing has continued to climb. So we have a lot of work still to do. And I think, what's the time like? I have a letter from a participant, which I think might be, and I'd like to close by reading. This is a letter that I literally crossed my desk on Monday, and I just felt it's maybe a lovely way to kind of close this. The Inside program is a program that serves individuals who are chronically homeless, who've been on the street for a very long time, and they also have a diagnosis of a mental illness. And typically the length of stay in housing is about 6 months. And this is from one of the participants who's writing a generic letter to the administration, the board of directors, anybody who helps support the Inside program. She says, "Hello, you and I may never meet in person, yet our lives and decisions are connected on unfathomable levels. We have more in common than you would like to think. We share a city, a language, common knowledge, rights, dreams, and wishes. I write to you now with fresh pain from the loss of my aunt, who was homeless and died yesterday from MRSA as a result of living in an unsafe environment. I write to you as a soon-to-be completed participant at the Inside program, a hardworking, thriving, bad at spelling, strong 24-year-old. I graduated from the University of Oregon in 2012 and came from an illiterate, heroin-addicted, mentally ill, abusive father, and a mother who abandoned me at 6 months old. It was my aunt who taught me to drive, put on makeup, got me my first job at Carl's Jr.'s, encouraged me to not only graduate high school but to obtain a higher education, and she died at 34 because there aren't enough people who can do what you do. I have lived a homeless life since I was very young and constantly strive for stability. I'm not the smartest person. I am very poor. I am labeled as mentally ill, yet I have lived a life impossible to obtain for my aunt. I can tell you without a shadow of doubt that the reason I overcame unsurmountable odds is because there have been people like yourself, people who have helped me meet my basic needs. Teachers helped me with the need for attention and sense of accomplishment. Therapies with the need to be heard. Employers with structure and responsibility. And the INSIDE program has met my basic need for stable housing for the past 6 months. Having housing, even for 6 months, has dramatically changed my life. I have become employed, independent. Relationships between families and friends have improved. Mental illness symptoms have gone away. I passed employment screening. Drug tests and addictions are no more. Many, if not all, of my obstacles have been removed just by having stable housing. My brain is healing from psychosis. I read the newspaper every day. I read difficult classic novels and understand them. Yet I still have a long way to go. My plan is to keep working at my job, to successfully find and keep my own apartment, and to forever be an advocate for those without the means, but do have the desire to survive as whole people, with humility and gratitude. Thank you.
Bob Cassidy, substitute first questioner. I was on the board when you first got started in this work, and I'm rather astounded at the transition that's gone on over the years. My question is a takeoff on your final letter from one of the clients. At the time I was on the board, I was really concerned about just how successful we were going to be, what happens to these people after they get out of the system. And I heard a couple of years later you were working in this direction to see in the justice system or in the prison system, they'd call it recidivism, how many people are successful after they get out, how many come back and go through the system again. Could you talk about this a bit?
I can, and we do. We actually keep statistics. We're part of, because of much of our funding comes from the county and through the federal HUD dollars, we have to keep very close statistics. About in our family program, we track that 60% of the folks that we serve leave our program into permanent housing, and we have a fairly good sense that they will be stable because our work with them is to make sure that they're. It's that affordability gap, that they're moving into a place that they can actually sustain. And with housing, a lot of the other stuff comes into play. With housing, then all of a sudden you have the focus to get up in the morning, you have the energy to go through the treatment processes that might be needed. In our permanent housing, in our the interventions that we do with chronic homeless, with adults with mental illness, the percentage is much higher. It's closer to 80% of the people leave our programs and then move on into permanent housing in the community and remain stable. So I really come to believe all that, and all the evidence tells us nationally that you get people into housing and then they honestly are willing to engage, and the wraparound supports are going to help them then remain stable. I hope that answered your question, Bob.
Okay, thank you. Now it's time for us to break so members can form questions for the presenter.
You are tuned to KLCC Eugene 89.7, 90.5 KLCO Newport, KLFR Reedsport 89.1, and at 88.1 KMPQ Roseburg, KLFO Florence, KLBR Bend, and on the web at klcc.org.
Welcome back to the City Club program, Shelter Care in the WIT, Renovating Buildings and Reviving Lives. On February 28th, our guest speaker is Susan Bann, Executive Director of Shelter Care, and we'll start with our questions.
I'm Robin Fletcher, and I'm a member since 2004. And my table was interested in how you're funding this project. It's a big one. And where is the money coming from, and from whom?
Okay, thanks. So as I mentioned earlier, the actual mortgage and the purchase of the building was through Oregon Facilities Administration through a small nonprofit assistance program. It's a mortgage program at very low interest. So we are paying off a mortgage for the purchase. Now, the remodeling has been a capital campaign effort, and we are 80% of our way toward meeting that goal, and we need to raise the remaining 20% in the next 6 months, but I think we're well on the way of doing that. We've had some great help from the New Market Tax Credit Program. Oregon adopted a mirror program to the federal New Market Tax Credit, and those are dollars that get invested into neighborhoods that are coming back to life after a long period of recession. And so Oregon's plan allowed us to take a smaller project. Usually the federal projects are like $10 million, and we were just a fraction of that, allowed us to take that project in, and we were one of the first New Market Tax Credit programs awarded. We also have a significant grant from Meyer Memorial Trust, and we have Collins Foundation dollars in it, and much, much more. And you can learn all about that on the website, www.sheltercare.org. It has much more comprehensive information than I can share here.
Betty Hosokawa, our table was wondering, we felt like that you clearly were a woman with vision and goals, and we were wondering where you're headed next after you get this building up and running.
We're actually very excited because we're redoing the model of care for supportive housing. And we have started doing supportive housing in the community for adults with serious mental illness in 1978. They were people who were coming to the community during the deinstitutionalization period. And that's, if you all remember, that's One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and the sort of embarrassment of the state hospitals nationally. And all of a sudden, we had all of these adults with psychiatric disabilities in the community with no supports to keep them in housing. So in 1978, our organization began doing that. And in 1982, opened Hawthorne Apartments. And since then, all of our services have really been centered in the facility. So we've been sort of like satellite services. Well, the really clear evidence says that doesn't work as well as bringing in specialists, co-locating them, and helping the individuals in the apartments be as independent as they can be. So truly what we're building here is a center for services that will allow a much broader scope of services and much higher quality of care and more independence for our residents. And I could go on and on and on, but it's just very exciting. We're beginning that work now.
Joanne Ernst, City Club member. We have two questions from the table. The first one is, do you have any housing or will you have any housing in the future that can accommodate people that have pets? Usually dogs and cats.
I'd say most of our units have a comfort or companion animal in them.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah. It's really not an exclusion. I mean, it's by law, anybody who's in an apartment holds the lease, they have a letter from their doctor, they're allowed a pet.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
And the other question is, I help a woman that's in permanent care facility. She was on the street for many, many years and ended up having lung problems and doing what you explained earlier, being having emergency treatment at the hospital and then being released. But she wouldn't go into care because they couldn't place her any place where her dog could go. So it got to the point now where she's in permanent care. Luckily, her dog's in foster care, so we take the dog to visit her. But although her physical needs are being met, her mental health needs are not being met. And I'm wondering if you have any outreach services to reach out to people like that, because I know there's other people in permanent care that would require, you know, the same sort of care.
That's a great question, and kind of ties in with the question earlier, because one of the goals that we'd like to do is recognize that not everybody who needs services is going to be in one of the units for which we provide service. So I don't have outreach workers, but it's been on our strategic plan for the last 6 years, and I think it's, especially as we begin working with the waiting list, something that we want to do. But the other place I would tell you to call, Joanne, is Lane Independent Living Alliance, because they have a peer service, they have two peer services that are providing support for folks who have mental health needs. And this might be an ideal opportunity to match one of them with the person you're serving.
Dan Solich, City Club member. I wonder if you could address the populations you serve and where they're from, and if there's a difference in the populations of homeless that we see. Some are seeking services, and some are just passing through and doing like self-service by like begging at the corner, yeah, picking up cans and that sort of thing.
I'd be glad to. And the majority of the individuals who are in our program are Lane County born and bred. Our last permanent address was a Lane County address. That's like 80% or more. And then there's surrounding counties, particularly moving south, not necessarily moving north, who don't have services in their county, and they come to us for services. So Lane County tracks data from everybody who's entered into any of our services across the community for homeless services, and their numbers are 73% are Lane County born and bred, or last made address, and then another 7% coming from a surrounding Oregon county, and 13% from out of state. So that's, you know, we do kind of track that. That isn't to say that there aren't an awful lot of what we might call travelers, people who move up and down the I-5 corridor. We, you know, they are, and especially during the summer months. So those are people who don't necessarily knock on our doors or want services. They're just taking care of themselves and moving through. So, Jerry?
Hi, Jerry Smith, City Club member, retired social worker, and a volunteer at First Christian Church, several homeless programs. I have never seen so many abandoned, untreated, mentally ill in the community as I've seen in the last couple of years. And the number is really increasing right now, and I think there have been cuts in services. The Tea Party County Commission that we've got has cut Lane County mental health services. Monday, a fellow came in who was really lost and mentally ill, and I called Lane County Mental Health, and I said, when can I bring him over for an intake? They said, we don't have walk-in intakes anymore, which is a terrible abandonment as far as I'm concerned. And then I said, well, how do you bring people into your service? Well, he has to telephone us, and then we will call him back sometime in the next 2 days. So homeless people can't sit by a telephone somewhere for 2 days waiting for a call to return. So that's another terrible loss and abandonment. And I heard you talking about intake. You know, could we get people clearly with long mental illness histories to you? Is that something that you do, or where should, do you, you've got any clue what I might be able to do for
yeah,
those?
Yeah, I think it's a problem. We have in this community several mental health providers, and we're all part of an association called Community Behavioral Health Consortium, CBHC. I think that several of them are really working hard to have one-day access. So that'd be, you know, tri-direction service, uh-huh, or options, or Center for Family Development. And you may have much better luck getting someone in within a 24-hour period of time to do that initial assessment.
Okay.
That would be what I would recommend. And then the other thing, you know about Royal Avenue and the crisis respite. And right.
Yes. I send people, although I have a master's degree, I send people to Whitebird because Royal Avenue does not accept a referral from
without
me.
Without a, you have to have a, right.
Yes. And those are good referrals. The other thing I want to say is I've seen your services. I have looked at your services for a number of years, and I think they're outstanding and very important to the community. What can we do to get you more funding so you can take on some of these unmet problems, particularly the dual diagnosis problems, people that are both mentally ill or mentally incompetent and are using substances like alcohol and drugs because they can't get medical care. Now, I've seen a couple of bright ones who have discovered just now that they can get medical care, and that's brand new.
Yeah, Oregon Health Plan is coming online.
Yes.
See that there's some folks in the line behind you. What I'll say, Jerry, is Laurel Hill Center is the other place, too, to think about. That the continued advocacy at the state level to make mental health investments a priority is very important. As the state legislature puts pressure on the budget and the Addictions and Mental Health Division, more dollars will flow to the county.
Thank you.
Hi. Hi. During your introduction, it was mentioned that I wasn't clear if it was Eugene or the Lane County area that was like had one of the 19th. It was 19th on this list of most unhoused homeless. Just wondering what your opinion is on why that's happening.
That was Dan's statistic from the one-night shelter count. So what I do know that in a larger picture, our Lane County has a very low medium wage. And it's one of the lower in the state of Oregon. And Oregon has a very low median wage relative to the nation. We don't necessarily have high housing costs, but the gap between housing costs and income is creates a hardship. And more than 50% of households who are renting in our community have a housing cost burden. More than 25% have a severe housing cost burden. It's hard, and we don't have a lot of single resident occupancy housing. Portland at least has old hotels that still have single units, so I think that's part of it. And our economy here struggles as well.
Yes, John Dillo, City Club member, and I had a couple of questions. One is, how will this new center differ from the First Place Family Center run by St. Vincent? And how many people or families can this new facility take care of?
Great. First Place Family Center works exclusively with families with children who are homeless, and it provides a lot more than we will. They have meals and showers. That's not what we're designing to do. Families are there during the day. It's a day access center, so they have a place to be. Again, that's not what we're doing. What we're providing are an array of services so that people can come in and get direct care. We serve about 150 families over the course of a year. Those are households. And then we will serve about 1,700 individuals.
Hi, Clay. Hi. Stevens, City Club member since 2013. My question is related to one of your last statements. You said that you track data, and a lot of these people are coming from out of county because of our superior services.
That's not what the data says. The data says no, that's not the
reason.
That's
not the reason.
No.
Okay.
The majority of people using the services are from Lane County, that's 73%, or from surrounding counties, which is another 7%. So you've got 80% of the people coming from local area.
Okay. Well, 20% of the people are coming out. How do we avoid, creating this, Lane County is so great at this, let's increase the maybe it increases the problem because they think it's so great to come here for these services you're providing. How do we avoid kind of increasing the problem from some of that?
In my experience, from the people who knock on our door for our services, they are local people and they're in the community because they have family here, they grew up here, and they're willing to make a commitment so that they can stay in this community. So while it's true, I think there was a story about a woman at the mission who came here for a job and was from out of area, but she came here for a job. And she'll get a job, and she'll be fine. So just to speak clear, I think people typically don't move to find services. People move because they like to move. You know, so the people, and this is your question too, Dan, it's like the people who are moving through our community are moving through our community. They may have an impact on the dining room and the food system. They may have an impact on our street corners. But for regular services, when we're really trying to attach people to a medical home, to a behavioral health home, to a system of housing care. Those are, by and large, local folks.
Dan Bryant, City Club member. So, Susan, also, and just response to that, because I was working on this editorial on this topic, and when I saw that 73% figure, I thought, I wonder how that compares to the congregation that I serve. So I did a little survey of that congregation and discovered that 61% of the congregation I serve had a previous address from Lane County. So in my own congregation, we have a higher mobility rate than among the homeless. And I suspect
that
is true in probably any group. So just check that out with the group in which you associate and see how it compares. So as a result, and by the way, that editorial is going to appear Sunday in the paper, and so you can read all about it then. But one of the editors quizzed me and asked me a question that I would just pose to you in trying to figure out how we resolve the current situation with Whoville. Of what services, you know, we have this community that is, you know, love it or not, that's caring for itself.
Right.
And the city has made a decision that it can't continue in that current state. So what solutions can we offer, what suggestions can we give to the city of how, is there a better way that we can resolve this without disbanding it so that that little community can continue to do that self-care?
Honestly, I've thought about this again and again and again, and I don't have an answer, Dan. I really don't. I appreciate the fact that the city, at least for some part of that community, will be finding a place where they can continue as a community. I also know that we, as service providers, are trying, you know, to make connections to move people into our programs as much as we can, but we're limited by capacity. We have taken on a Whovillian through our homeless medical respite program, and we have another person from Sleeps that's working with our transitional program, but, you know, we don't have a lot of access. We have to do these one at a time, so I wish there were a better answer. I think long-term there are some exciting answers, and Dan and I have talked about, you know, the possibility of micro-housing or building different kinds of structures that are much less costly, much more affordable, so that people who are at that very low-income part of the strata would have a place to be, and we wouldn't need to have tent cities. We could actually have housing cities. So, thanks.
Another question before you run away. James Baldock, City Club member from 2012. I guess I'm going to follow up on the Whoville question. I kind of wanted to know what your thoughts are. The City Council is considering various options to make it a lot more permanent than it is right now. I wanted to know your thoughts on the matter and whether it's helpful in transitioning people out of homelessness.
I think stability is always helpful in transitioning people out of homelessness, and I think what Dan and his group are doing with Opportunity Village is an illustration of that. It's not easy. It takes time, but as people feel more stable and feel safe and have a good night's sleep and meals under their belt and can get the care that they need, it becomes possible for folks to begin to envision their own future. So those are the kinds of solutions we're going to need to adopt as a community long term. Unfortunately, it doesn't happen overnight, and so trying to come up with a solution for Whoville before April 30th or April 1st is feels undaunting. It feels daunting and unmanageable.
Hi.
Hi.
This is Jerry Smith again with another question. When kids are in school here in special education and in foster homes, I find that particularly if they drop out of school, at whatever age they drop out of school, they are more or less abandoned. It may be that school wasn't good enough to help them in the first place, but they were identified as having emotional problems. They were identified as having behavioral problems, and their reading and writing levels and the ability to deal with paperwork is almost nil. And I'm now finding people who are 20 years homeless, having been abandoned when they turned 18. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I've recently gotten a couple in your program. That makes me feel really good. Mm-hmm. What can we do to... Can you take them earlier if we see somebody? Sometimes it's a little hard. You don't want to just call them stupid. You know, that's what the community seems to be doing. You know, they don't hire them. They don't... There's no way to... There's no program for taking care of them. And we have these people sort of just stumbling around in abandonment that I wish we could hook up into care systems earlier. What do you recommend for somebody 15 to 22 or so? Do you have programs that could reach them as individuals?
We typically work with adults 18 and older. I would partner with Looking Glass on that. We did for a while have a program where Looking Glass was referring people to us. But again, they were 18. And that's kind of when our array of services comes into play. And I do agree. I mean, I've seen myself, you know, adults who are now 50 who can't read, can't write, and have been... I'm thinking of one in particular. I basically have been homeless and on the street since they were 15, and it's a tragedy. Hi, Joanne.
Hi. Joanne Ernst, City Club member. There's been a movement in the last few years for what's called the wet housing for people that you know, haven't beat their substance abuse problems yet. Do you have any... facilities like that, or have you thought about those?
We do. I mean, let me say, we do housing first, and we do harm reduction, and those are the PC terms. So housing first means, yes, we definitely are taking people off of the street who have an active abuse or alcohol or substance abuse issue, and we work with them in their housing. So our goal, I mean, so alcohol and substance abuse is not a barrier to housing. And I think... our approach, using independent housing apartments scattered in the community, is probably better than what has been kind of thought about nationally as wet housing, which is more like a dormitory filled with people who then kind of can stimulate each other in unhealthy ways. So we use motivational interviewing, we use harm reduction, we use a variety of ways to help that individual begin to set goals for his or her life. Now that they're in housing. And it's amazing that actually substance abuse, alcohol abuse will drop when people are now focused on, well, maybe getting a job, or I always wanted to go back to school, or I really enjoy volunteering out at Green Hill. I mean, so it's, you know, it's partly kind of redirecting people's attention toward other possibilities.
Okay, well, thank you for bringing clarity and vision to the City Club program, Shelter Care in the WIT, renovating buildings and reviving lives. And thanks again to our sponsors, the Oregon Country Fair, Hearing Associates, and Dot Dotsons. We meet again next Friday on March 7th at the Downtown Athletic Club to hear Girl of the Golden West, Strong Women in the Gold Rush Era. Lunches for this program can be ordered on the City Club's website or by contacting the office. Thank you very much.
take your daddy's fine car and drive me around. And we used to make love on the outskirts of town. Say you were no good. They didn't even like you in your own neighborhood. They said when I wasn't around, you wouldn't put me down. So I got me a little home on the outskirts of town. Well, baby, you lift me up and you set me down. I never thought I would make it on the outskirts of town. Yeah. enjoying the show? Do you have some other place that you want to go? Well, we can get crazy, and I can't express how I feel about you, darling. What's underneath that dress? You know how I wish that I could see what's been warming the hell out of me. Ooh, yes, 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 yes. What's underneath that dress? So open up a little wider so I can see what's been warming. Yes, 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 yes.